This is The Good Fight with Barbara McGuigan on EWTN Radio. It's all about saints, past, present, and future. You can be a saint too. Listen and learn. Now, here's your host, Barbara McGuigan.
A good day to you and to each of our esteemed listeners. Welcome to The Good Fight. Barbara McGuigan here, alive and grateful, as I always say, but these words have taken on a whole new meaning in the midst of COVID-19. This is a very challenging time for every last one of us, but I can honestly say that my peace, I can speak for myself, my peace and serenity is even stronger than usual because of a certain consolation that our gracious God has supplied for every last one of us. And that is, maybe you can guess, watching the Holy Mass that is being streamed over the internet. God will never abandon us, and this is yet another sign of his loving provision. EWTN's Daily Masses, Word on Fire Masses with Bishop Barron, Ascension Presents Masses with Father Mike Schmitz, and even on many parish websites. If you look up your website within your own community, they will sometimes, most often around here anyway, they air the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass. And that's just naming a few. I'm sure you know of others. So we offer up to God our spiritual communions as we obediently accept the circumstances that prohibit receiving the body and blood of Christ at his altar. It's a beautiful gift. You see, God always provides for his children. As St. Catherine of Siena said, God loves us with an inestimable love. So let's never forget that, even more so in the midst of such a serious plague. Today on The Good Fight, we will be blessed. Catherine Pakulik and Trent Horn, co-authors of Can a Catholic Be a Socialist?, will break down for us the reason why the answer is a resounding no. In light of the fact that socialism is rearing its ugly head, so much so that in 2019, 43% of Americans considered socialism to be a good thing, and millennials are some of its strongest supporters, half of them actually saying in one poll that they would prefer life in a socialist country to a capitalist one. I mean, Houston, we have a problem. Actually, America, we have a problem. Without formation, error reigns supreme. Without knowledge of history, groupthink always looks pretty appealing, especially when it promotes or promises and promotes vote power that favors those who want things for free. Free food, welfare, housing, healthcare, even free college. Now, most of us know that ignorance is not bliss, but it can also be dangerous. How many young people could intelligently explain the demise of Venezuela? At the time Venezuela made Hugo Chavez the president, it had one of the best economies and highest per capita incomes in Latin America. The lure of socialism, where the government controls and distributes most everything, overwhelmed the country. 20 years or so later, upwards of 3 million people have fled from Chavez's what he called new and improved socialism, and his people are starving. I read a while ago how public restrooms were overflowing, escalators didn't work, public water systems and street lighting are unreliable. And because some of their people eat from public refuse, garbage, the average citizen lost 20 pounds. In January 2019, a little over a year ago, the stats told the story. Nearly 90% of their population live in poverty, and hyperinflation is nearing 1,000,000%. Now, Venezuela looks like a war zone when it used to be a country rich in oil. Bottom line, socialism destroyed Venezuela. Now, aside from talking about socialism today, we will discuss capitalism as well. One of my favorite chapters in Trent's and Catherine's comprehensive book is their chapter 20 on Catholicism and moral capitalism. They write, even those who know that capitalism is not intrinsically wrong may still imagine that walking the path of moral capitalism is like strolling along the edge of a cliff. Step over the line too far in one direction or another, and you might fall into exploitation, abuse, or greed. But this isn't how the church sees it, and it isn't how we should see it either. Our authors cite Michael Novak's greatest work, The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism. As a friend of Pope St. John Paul II, Michael talked about the three-legged stool that was needed for a healthy political economy comprising, number one, free and democratic political order, two, economy of free enterprise, and three, and this could be one of the most important ones, virtuous citizens shaped by a sound moral order. Each of these, he believed, vitally depended upon a strong religious framework, and the absence of any of these elements would sabotage any economy. End quote. Brothers and sisters, as Trent and Catherine explain, capitalism isn't bad, but I suppose you could say some capitalists are. But we must be aware, and I love this part where they said, as sons and daughters of God, we are more than producers, consumers, utility maximizers, or even shoppers. We are Christians, which means capitalism isn't a way of life, much less our identity. However optimistic we are about entrepreneurship, business and free markets, economic values are not and cannot be the only values. Our first identity is not that of a laborer, producer, or consumer, but a disciple of Jesus Christ, working out our salvation through his church. Jesus, we trust in you. Please inspire all men and women, especially our young people, to understand that communism, socialism, and nihilism are hideous deformities of the civil society of men and almost its ruin, in the words of Pope Leo XIII. Amen. And now I have the joy of introducing to you Dr. Catherine Pakolik. Catherine is assistant professor at the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America. She specializes in the economics of education and religion, family studies and demography, Catholic social thought, and political economy. Pakolik earned her doctorate at Harvard University in 2010, where she studied under 2016 Nobel laureate Oliver Hart. She has authored and co-authored highly cited articles in journals, including Economic Inquiry, Journal of Markets and Morality, Demography, and the Journal of the National Cancer Institute. Pakolik is a widely admired writer and sought-after speaker on matters of culture, gender, social science, the vocation of women, and the work of Edith Stein. She lives in Maryland with her husband, philosopher Michael Pakolik, and 8 children. God bless her. Welcome to The Good Fight, Dr. Pakolik.
Thank you so much. It's just a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, my goodness. You will have plenty of time to rest in heaven, too. I can't imagine all the things that you do. And as the oldest of 11, you know, I know what it's like to have a big family. Very much fun and a lot of work. I don't know how you do it.
One day at a time.
That's right.
I have a great husband and partner in life.
Oh, see, that's the way it should be. That is so beautiful. And you know, my mom has her own economic theory. Whenever anyone looked at her, we used to go to the store on the weekends, and sometimes all of us would be with her, you know. Right. And people would look at her like, "What? Are these all your kids?" You know. And she would always say, "Every baby brings his own sandwich."
Yes, isn't it true?
She's an Irish lady, so she's got all kinds of things like this. Well, listen, before we get into the nitty-gritty of socialism, I'd like to revisit for a minute the words of Pope Leo XIII regarding the fact that economic values are not and cannot be the only values, that capitalism isn't a way of life, much less our identity. Tell me this, how do we practically break free from capitalism's consumerist temptations?
Yeah, so I'm delighted that you want to lead off with this, because I, like you, this was one of my most favorite chapters to work on. And I think that one of the things we talk about in the book is kind of rules for life. I mean, we make the comparison to, you know, to food and to our habits with food, but it's like all those other things that what the church recommends to us when we're thinking about things that are wholesome and good, right? We're not thinking about, you know, anything that's off the table that's really bad or sinful, right? There's nothing sinful about economic activity, shopping and producing and working. On the contrary, actually, we must shop. We must.
Sure.
Yeah. We must work. And in fact, they're deep. Those things are deeply part of who we are as creative persons made in the image of God, actually. But like anything else, they can get out of order. They can get a little bit bloated. And actually, that's part of the role of sin, is to kind of promote things that have less value above the things that have most value. And so actually, you know, it's, we can usually sort of think our way through it, but we don't always have the strength to do it, right? So we kind of know deep down, you know, I probably shouldn't be scrolling through my Amazon app on a Sunday morning when I'm about to head off to church. Like, probably that's like things have gotten out of order. We've probably all, most of us, done that once or twice.
Oh, yes.
Times, you know. But it's this kind of like the creeping of certain things out of order. So the point is that we can look at those patterns in our lives and kind of realize like things are kind of getting out of order here. But in fact, because in all things, sin makes us weak, we need the grace that the church offers to help put things in order. So it's kind of a two-part sandwich, right? It's kind of thinking through what are those proper values, and if in case we don't know that we should dedicate Sunday to the Lord, the church of course helps us to get our priorities in order, to put things in the right order. And then the second piece is, you know, how do you get that extra strength to do the things that you are not quite able to do? Well, you have to sort of really deep dig down and rely on the sacraments. So we need to kind of do both things, but to start, just to recognize that just because a thing has gotten out of order in our lives, we are consumerist, we think about shopping too much, say. I mean, this is not a problem for everyone, but it is for some people. That it doesn't mean the thing itself is bad, but it does mean that maybe we need to change our habits a little bit, or check what's gotten out of line. And I was sort of, in the book, we recommended to think about this the way we think about Lent. Right, we fast from things which are perfectly good and wholesome things, like certain kinds of food on certain times. There's nothing wrong with meat, but we offer it up on Fridays.
Right.
And we could extend that into our economic life a little bit. I mean, obviously no one's gonna fast from their job if they have to be at work, but we can think of all different ways to put things back in order. And that's sort of the beginning. I mean, kind of that last chapter is really the beginning of something, right? It's not the end of the book. It's so maybe we'll write more about it later.
You know, when I saw it, I thought, you know what? I want to start with this because this is something so important. So I just thought I'd put it in the first questions. But
yes.
And you explain it so well. Once again, we go back to Holy Mother Church. This is where it all, this is where it goes on. I mean, this, if you want to be holy, this is where you got to make sure that you know what you are practicing and why you are practicing and receiving the sacraments. And like, look at us now. I mean, I know you can stream and that's a wonderful thing, but I never thought in my life, Catherine, that there would be a situation where our churches would be locked down. I mean, it's so darn sad. So you're listening to The Good Fight, my brothers and sisters, on EWTN, Global Catholic Radio Network. I'm Barbara McGuigan here with Dr. Catherine Pakulik. We will be right back. Stay with us.
This is The Good Fight on EWTN Radio. For more information about The Good Fight, go to EWTN.com and click on radio. Here again is Barbara McGuigan.
Welcome back to The Good Fight. And before we go back to Dr. Catherine, word on fire. I want to talk about that. Bishop Robert Barron of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles hosts on EWTN the Word on Fire show. The trusted clarity of Bishop Barron illustrates the truth, goodness, and beauty of Catholicism. And that's the Word on Fire show, Sundays at 10:30 a.m. and 4 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time on EWTN Radio. Okay, now back to this. Doctor, I'd like you to address these words, but carefully crafted economic policies by themselves are not enough to bring about authentic human fulfillment. That's a quote by Pope Leo XIII. What did he mean? And all the other pontiffs who tirelessly proclaimed that rejecting socialism is only part of the solution, what did Pope Leo insist upon, and how did he see the other part of the solution?
Yeah, so that's another great, great question. So, you know, it's interesting that in Rerum Novarum, when the Pope weighed in on socialism, he only dedicated the first several paragraphs to socialism. And he thought kind of the easy part was rejecting socialism. He thought, well, that's kind of obvious. I mean, he goes ahead and explains it for us. But then he says, but now let's turn to the real solution. And of course, he's the Roman pontiff and he has care of the souls of the faithful. So the real solution, he says, is really something that only the church can help us achieve, right? Which is sort of like this, we have this image of the good society or the virtuous society, a society in which peace reigns. He was very worried about revolution and war at that time, and he was right to be worried about that. So the other part of the solution is the role of the church. So Pope Leo warned right away, he said, if the church is supposed to sort of recede or pull back from society, that would be disastrous, that the church has to actually step up and play more of a role. And he wasn't necessarily calling for a policy change on the part of the church or any particular country, but he was kind of appealing to the fact that when things are socially unstable, like think about now, when things are socially unstable, it's a time when we need the grace that the church brings to us even more.
But I love to, and thank you for that explanation, I love how you then said, there's no magic bullet. There's no quick fix, be it a bloody or unbloody revolution or a set of policy platforms that can make the world perfectly good. There's always the cross. See, this I think sometimes if some more people understood that they will have many joys in life, for Pete's sake, many joys, but they will also have many sorrows, don't you think?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point and something we have to reflect on. I mean, we are called, of course, to sort of to leave a mark, to make things better, to blaze a trail, right? We understand that.
Yeah.
But it's so easy for us to forget that that's a spiritual mission, and that frequently, and we're blessed if it does, frequently it leaves its imprint in a visible way that we can see we've made things better. But sometimes it doesn't, right? I don't know if Catherine of Siena, when she died, I don't know if she thought she had brought the difference that she would have liked to have seen. Many people have said that she kind of failed, right? But that's the sort of mystery of both the cross and also like what it means to have a supernatural vocation.
Yes.
We are very worldly. I mean, our natural state, you know, how we're born, we see with these eyes. And we don't always see.
My sister said to me, you just reminded me, she says to me, how am I going to get my nails done now? Because we're all, you know, on lockdown, basically.
And
I said, Mary, this is a first world problem you're looking at here. You know, I mean, let's put it into perspective, right?
I know. I mean, listen, I do frequently get these questions from folks. They say, you know, well, you're a Catholic and you're an economist and, you know, what's the package of kind of family friendly or church friendly policies we should put into place? And I mean, I'm usually very disappointing. I mean, I'm usually kind of like, look, you can do as much harm as good with almost any policy under the sun.
Amen.
I would rather we, you know, got a little bit more calm about all the good we think we can do with these policies and kind of adopted a little bit of humility about what we can accomplish, right? So we know we can accomplish a lot of harm. We're not always clear we can accomplish some good. We have to be kind of careful in what we do there. But it is a very common question I get, you know, like, isn't there sort of a right answer? Isn't there a single way we could organize the economic life to kind of make it all work out, you know? I feel like the answer is disappointingly no. We're not going to make it all perfect.
But you could if... You really could. We really could if everyone was formed and virtuous. Yeah?
Yes. I mean, I think that a community of angels would look very different.
Well, that's never going to happen.
We'll say community of good angels. We'll say that.
Okay, good. Yeah.
But, you know, that's we've been told this, and we know this. This is not the city of God yet.
Amen. Oh, we're so far from it. It makes you sad sometimes. Well, now, Catherine, let's define our terms.
Yes.
What exactly is socialism, and why Pope Leo XIII said socialism must be utterly rejected? Because we'll get into this, how there are many people that don't feel this way.
Right. So the socialism that Pope Leo is talking about, what we'll think about as kind of classical socialism. And there's usually two parts to classical socialism. The first, which is kind of prior, is the abolition of private property. So you just, in one particular way or another, you abolish it, you confiscate it, you take it away. It could be like little by little. It doesn't have to be all at once. But the abolition of private property, which doesn't also, but by the way, also extends beyond land or, you know, houses and land, but it can also mean just what people save up in the bank. But the abolition of private property. And the second thing is, on some level, the nationalization or the state ownership of business and production.
Yeah. Okay.
And those two things tend to go together. But in some instances, we've seen, you know, part of one or the other. But those are the two pillars of classical socialism. And when Pope Leo is writing, he speaks primarily about the first one, the abolition of private property. And he says it must be utterly rejected for, you know, a million reasons. It's actually amazing how much he packs into those first 15, 17 paragraphs.
Yes.
But maybe the shorthand way of thinking about it is that it's for Pope Leo, it's contra nature, right? So it's something that, because it's against our human nature and the way which God expected us and built us to relate to the created order, that every time we try it, it doesn't work out, right? It's like fitting a square peg in a round hole.
Right.
You know, it's not, this time won't be different. This time will be the same because it's not how we're made. So Pope Leo says it's against nature. And for many reasons, he unpacks them. We talk about those things, but it's also against the tradition of the church. The church has always been against the abolition of private property. And it's against what's handed down to us in scripture. I mean, that's connected to tradition, but it's against what we know from scripture. Those are all the reasons, but it has to be utterly rejected. And Pope Leo, he has a big heart. When you read Rerum Novarum, you see how much he's kind of bleeding for the people. He says, this is going to hurt people we're trying to help more than ever. You know, sort of that's the tragedy of it, is that it's usually proposed as a way to help those who are relatively worse off, those who are poor, working class. But he says it's actually the working class will be most hurt by this. And so he's sort of pulling his hair out, you know, and he's worried about all kinds of related problems. It will hurt the working class. It will break down the family. It will undermine the fiber of civil society because the family will be undermined. It will certainly eat away or corrode the relationship that people should have with the church. many different things that he talks about, and he doesn't have light language for socialism.
He tells it, does he not?
Yes, he
really tells it. You know, it's disturbing though when you watch the large segment of young people distrusting capitalism.
Yes.
I mean, I know they've been propagandized, really, when you think about it. I guess that's the right way to say that word. But after the economic crisis in 2010, and we were in that, too. My husband was in real estate at that time.
Yeah.
We were killed by that. They've become skeptical, these kids, of saving for their retirement. But it's even more disturbing when you become aware of all the popes who address socialism in very strong words, as you said. And so when we come back, I want you to tell us, some of the most vocal advocates for socialism, though, are Christian theologians and committed Catholics. I want to know how this can be. We'll be right back, my brothers and sisters. You're listening to The Good Fight on EWTN Radio. We'll be right back.
This is The Good Fight on EWTN Radio. For more information about The Good Fight, go to EWTN.com and click on radio. Here again is Barbara McGuigan.
Welcome back to The Good Fight. I would like to mention CNA, Catholic News Agency, is the only fast, reliable, and free Catholic news source that brings blogs, stories, opinions, and more to your fingertips. For the latest Catholic news, visit CatholicNewsAgency.com. It's an online service from EWTN News. Okay, Catherine, here we go. How is it? How is it that Christian theologians and committed Catholics, how they can promote, or their advocates, I don't know how much they actually promote it, but they support socialism?
Well, so one of the things we talk about in the book is this strain of really Catholic theology, unfortunately, which we now call liberation theology, which
yes,
is a strain
yes.
of really Marxist thought that entered into the minds and hearts of a number of Catholic theologians, really predominantly in the 1970s. It was kind of kicking around already in the 1960s. This was a time, the 1960s and the 1970s, when there was among a lot of intellectual elites a certain trend or a fad in favor of a kind of, I don't know, like a nicer, softer Marxism, something that, you know, we didn't associate with classical socialism once it had become known to us politically in the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And so these folks, it was kind of an intellectual fad for them. And, you know, again, like most of the time, at least with the elites, the leaders of movements who come up with ideas, you know, on the ideas on the page, although, I mean, I think they could have been sniffed out as being really repulsive, you know, the goal is always a good one. It was like, you're looking at some of these Latin American countries at the time, these were mostly Latin American theologians, and saying, gosh, you know, this business economy that people have in the North, it's just not catching on here. There's something wrong. Something is going wrong. And so they concluded incorrectly that, you know, capitalism was just not the answer, that capitalism couldn't work, that capitalism was fatally flawed itself, and that we had to kind of go back to this other solution. You know, so that was a really big mistake. But they wrote a lot of things, or a lot of books, a lot of articles. Some of them were pretty influential people, to the point where this stuff got so popular that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith at the time under then Cardinal Ratzinger really had to issue many statements to kind of try to nip this in the bud. So it was a pretty serious thing. It got very much attention. And, you know, but that's, you know, I don't worry about that in the sense that in every age, the devil is always up to what he's up to. But there it is. And it doesn't have to really, it doesn't have to surprise us. You know, it needs to be refuted, but it doesn't have to surprise us or make us lose our peace. But there it is.
Yeah. So I'll try not to lose my peace.
Well, you know, you know what I mean. I mean,
I so know what you mean. I so know what you mean.
Kind of, you know, humor that you, it's like with your kids, you know,
yeah,
kids around the house, and the 3-year-old is a little naughty, and you know, it happens. It's what happens. And I guess there's a way you can, I mean, I think John Paul II viewed it this way. He was very against it, but he also sort of, he wasn't shocked by it, but it was there.
Yeah, that's the truth. Well, now, but here's the, this is what always gets me is, okay, we know. I mean, it's not a secret that socialism is one step away from communism.
Yeah.
I mean, but actually in the in this particular book, I think I read where you said that it's kind of one and the same. When you're referring to socialism, you can also be.
Yeah.
Is that correct? What's the difference between the two?
A popular sociology textbook that that makes the point that sort of for practical purposes, we usually think of them as the same. I mean, that would be another, you know, 2 or 3 hour segment to kind of pick apart the different factions of political theorists and economic theorists and theologians who think that there's all various subtle differences between socialism and communism. And believe me, as soon as we're over, and if you want to go look on the reviews on our book on Amazon, you'll find, you know, an immediate grouchy complainer who says they don't know the difference between socialism. I mean, you, over time, people will constantly say there's some, you know, deep nuance differences. They're not really deep nuance differences. We can kind of, with a broad brushstroke, say that, you know, communism is has a certain form of political expression that's usually, again, associated with Karl Marx and his his particular ideas going back to the Communist Manifesto. When we think of political revolutionary forces in society, we think about, again, communism. We tend to think about communism, you know, but actually, in general, the communists and the socialists use fairly interchangeable language. It always sounds like they're reading from about exactly the same playbook, you know. So I mean, I could pick out some popular political figures now, but I don't necessarily want to do that. We do that a little bit in the book. But
you do, yeah, right. That's not, that's
it's
fine.
Not worth the nitty gritty. I mean, we could kind of drill down. You can always ask people what they identify with. Are they socialist or communist? But by and large, they're reading from the same playbook. And the instincts are wrong, right? So a socialist may come to you and say, no, look, you know, that's all, you know, communism is definitely bad. You know, those are people with guns and machetes, and they want to change everything and revolt with blood. And the socialists, we just have this nicer idea of things. You know, we're kind of much more moderate people. You know, in reality, when you look at various places, you know, Venezuela has tried to talk exclusively about socialism and not about communism. But in reality, you know, they're always going in the same place.
The principles were the same. Yes.
Right.
And that's the thing.
Yes.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I just want, when you, we know now, you know, how the resident socialists in our own country right now, how they sell their product, they go after the villains, which are the 1%. They're always talking about the 1% who have all the money, they say. So those who produce become the public enemy class.
Yes.
And you have comprehensively broken down socialism's fatal flaws. And oh my goodness, what a book. My brothers and sisters, this book, everybody needs to have at least one copy of these in their own house.
Yes.
Because you, especially if you have, like I do, you know, teenage grandkids, and, you know, most of them are spot on. Not in my house, they're all spot on. But I'm talking about, you know, some of my nieces and nephews, they're young too. And I'm going, oh my goodness, where did you get that? Can you talk about the breakdown of that you give? That'd be great.
I can talk about some of the things in the book. But I think maybe for our audience now, I mean, just thinking about things we've all seen recently in the news, let's think about toilet paper for a minute.
Yeah, okay.
If you don't mind.
I have 60 rolls.
Yes, so toilet paper. So one of the things with toilet paper, what we've just seen, we've had these shortages, right? And then, of course, once the shortages started, then people were trying to sell toilet paper for a lot of money. Same thing happened with the hand sanitizer. And it reveals a little bit of what prices do for us. So prices communicate all kinds of information to us. So when we think about socialism, the idea or the fantasy, the fiction behind socialism or communism is that, you know, there'll be this free stuff floating around. And when things are free, like, nobody will be jealous of things. But when we saw that people were worried about running out of toilet paper, and toilet paper is relatively cheap, what happened is that nobody rationed themselves the way that we think virtuous people ought to, right?
So nobody's
like, well, I'm going to go in and just take what I need. Like, what do I need to get through the next week? We saw instead a lot of so-called hoarding. Right?
Like my 60 free rolls.
Yes, when things are free, or when they are, let's say, priced too cheaply for the present circumstances. People will not self-ration. Only very virtuous people will self-ration. The saints will self-ration. The saints come in and say, I only need one roll. I'm living by myself. I can make one roll last a week. But they have no other people who are not saints, who are a little bit more, you know, let's just say a victim of their own passions. They kind of, you know, they just are going to take a few extras. And that right there just tells you why socialism doesn't work, right? I mean, I can apply that lesson a million times over. What prices do for us is that they help us to self-ration. They help us to control our passion and think, wait, rationally, how much toilet paper do I exactly need? And so actually the kind of the best thing in the situation is for the price to go up.
Yes.
So actually it's good for hand sanitizer to get expensive in a crisis because you don't want people walking in. So sure, you can institute a control on price, you know, on hand sanitizer or toilet paper. My local supermarket says only two rolls. The trouble
yes.
is if you try to run an entire economy by making everything free and then saying now everybody, now we're going to ration it out so you can only have two of these and one of those, forget about it. You are done. You are going to have a country plagued with shortages. Nobody will get what they need. Everybody is just complete chaos. The prices are elegant and they're beautiful because they have this kind of, I mean, right, people will talk about the invisible hand. People say they're sort of a magical thing. I can think of some political economists who said that the price mechanism, how they work in that respect, should be thought of as one of the great discoveries of humanity. Right? You know, meaning it's something we discovered. We didn't make it up. Like, this is why the Pope says socialism is against our nature.
Yes.
Like, God created us rational in this way. And we're meant to sort of stop and think, you know, how many exactly do I need? And there's some natural mechanism for me to choose just what I need and not anymore.
You know what?
Yeah. With socialism. Yes.
Not to interrupt, but this is funny because my son-in-law works he's a manufacturer. As a matter of fact, he's manufacturing all these stands for ventilators right now. Getting orders for thousands and thousands and thousands of them. Yeah. And he's up all night, every night, trying to, you know, talking to different countries and everything who put in these orders. But anyway, he was telling us that this about back to the toilet paper, that the Taiwanese told him that this was over a month ago, before we even had all this hoarding business. He said that there won't be any big container ships coming. We get all of our toilet paper from China. Did you know that? Uh-huh. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I mean, who
yeah.
cares, really? But I mean, there wouldn't be any container ships even coming. And so my husband went and bought 60 rolls. But I felt bad after that because I thought, my gosh, now.
Well, you had early information, which is great.
But I know, but then we, you know. No. But so my husband told him at work that he was going to charge $10 a roll anybody who wanted. I'm kidding. He did tell him that, but he was teasing, right?
No.
But here's the thing. One member in our recent political campaign refers to democratic socialism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a prettier way to say it, for sure. And I read that Hitler started out with these same two words. Have you heard that before? I read that he called it democratic socialism as well.
Yeah.
How do you respond when they claim that democratic socialists just want to build a world where everyone has a right to food, healthcare, a good home, an enriching education, and a union job that pays well? That's all. That's a quote.
Yeah.
I mean, no one would dispute that. So please address for me, for us, all of us, government social welfare versus socialism. Are they one and the same? And can Catholics support the establishment of socialist policies even through democratic means?
So those are all great questions. And there were like 20 great questions all about. So, but let me just see if I can work.
Sorry about that.
But very quickly, let's see. No one does dispute wanting those things: food, healthcare, a good home, a great education, a job that pays well. So I think the difference between what the socialists are up to or interested in and what I would say, well, typically speaking, the ordinary scope of human life, a capitalist order is much better at delivering any of those things than any sort of socialist order, right? So, I mean, if you want food and healthcare and a good home right now, Venezuela is not the place to go, right?
Right.
That is not something that any sort of socialist or even democratic socialist can promise you. They can't get it for you. So now let's talk about those democratic socialists. Most of the ones that we're thinking about in this country or maybe in Europe, they're not actual classical socialists. And actually, I sort of think they're using the wrong word. As you say, they're really thinking about more generous forms of social welfare than we now undertake, or that they would like to do that. And there's a certain amount of tinkering with the generosity of social welfare programs that just has nothing to do with socialism, right? It's not socialism.
Right.
It's not abolishing private property. Although at certain levels, you might need to take an abolishing amount of taxes to pay for it.
Oh, amen.
So to your specific question, yes. I mean, there are certainly, I think, legitimate disagreements that Catholics can have about the extent to which we want to have, let's say, social safety nets to help those people for whom access to food or healthcare has fallen through the cracks of the system. Those are interesting debates, and they're really difficult debates, because what we know from the experience we have with the welfare system in this country is that the more generous you make the system, the more difficult it is, A, to pay for the system, and also the more difficult it is to prevent, you know, the disincentives that it provides people, right? So people maybe don't have as much incentive to get jobs because they're being supported. So those are difficult decisions, but those are things people can disagree with and Catholics can disagree with. But certainly they can't be advocating these kind of, let's say, generous social welfare programs because they think this is a first step to socialism, right? That's where they want to head. Now, that would be a bad idea, right? Because it's kind of wrong instinct for a Catholic to have. Like, I want to put it that way. The Catholic mind doesn't look around and say, we need to get more stuff to people by taking more stuff from people and giving it to people, right? It's not a Catholic instinct. It's a disordered instinct.
Yes.
So Pope Leo talked about this being a kind of theft, which is motivated by greed and envy. We don't talk about that very much anymore. And actually, poor people can have envy and greed as much as rich people can have envy and greed. We are all sinners. We all have these disordered hearts. So I think there are reasonable disagreements about how you get those good things for people. And I've dedicated my life to thinking about education and how we can get more education to more people. And the church, this is part of the church's mission in the world, and it's a wonderful vocation. So I think we can do many, many things, but I definitely don't think democratic socialism is a kind of a path to better human goods. Yeah.
But you're so right. It all comes down to education, formation, really.
Yes.
It's such a critical need, especially when you have to start when they're young, for Pete's sake, you know, and
okay. So
well, now, how do you respond to those who say Catholics not only can be socialists, they should be socialists because that's how the first Christians lived? This was interesting to me in your book.
Yeah. So we have, I will say Trent is more of a specialist in this area than I am, for sure. But when we think about the early first Christians, what we should be thinking about is the voluntary giving up of, again, things which are good. Private property is a good thing. But some people, since the beginning of Christianity and the following disciples of Jesus, have felt called to live something we've always called heroic, right? A kind of heroic path. These days, when you look around, you want to say, who's doing that? Like those early first Christians did in some communities, you'd have to say members of religious orders are doing that. Mm-hmm. So that's always been a path in the church to voluntarily give up your property, to live the kind of poverty, we sometimes call it radical poverty, that Jesus Christ picked for himself, right? He always says that he picked for himself to lead a life where he had nowhere to lay his head. This was his choice to live this way. He also lived a celibate life. But we know that celibacy is not imposed on all of us because Jesus followed that path, or because many early Christians lived celibacy. It's a heroic path, and it's a path that's ordered to the next life. And in fact, it's a higher call in a certain way. But it's certainly not something that should be imposed at the level of the state on everyone. So that would be a big mistake, kind of a logical fallacy or like a category mistake, to sort of impose like the poverty of the religious orders on all of society.
Well, but can't they reason a little bit farther then to say that Jesus did not require his followers to support government confiscation and allocation of wealth? I mean,
that's correct.
Right? I mean, that's just so the early church was not a socialist church, yes?
No, it was not a socialist church. We have lots and lots of early church fathers and evidence from the early church to support this. Because this canard about the early church being socialist comes back, you know, over and over in lots of generations. And it's just not supportable. You know, and then it emerges pretty quickly into the, you know, we'll say the magisterial writings of the early church, right? So it emerges really quickly. I often like to point out, what is the point of the commandment not to steal if you can't own anything?
Right.
This is pretty deep. I mean, private property and the commandment not to envy other people's stuff, not to take it, not to envy it. It's right there at the beginning of the Jewish tradition, you know. So it's not, you know, don't own property. It's don't take other people's stuff.
Goodness.
That kind of ends it. It's like, well, okay, if God didn't say don't own, I mean, when he had a chance, here's the top 10 list, top 10 commandments. We are actually told to respect other people's property.
Right. So, yeah. That's a good point. That is a great point. And, you know, we're getting down to the wire here, but I want to ask you this question.
Mm-hmm.
You have a great chapter on what is capitalism's greatest sin, which led early socialists to seize on these injustices and prompted Pope Leo XIII to write Rerum Novarum. And at the same time, Marx and Engels were publishing the Communist Manifesto, about whom Pope Leo wrote, "The discussion is not easy, nor is it void of danger, because there are crafty agitators," he called them, "who, quote, pervert men's judgments and stir up the people to revolt," end quote. So, I mean, we're seeing this today. And yes. I think of Viktor Frankl's words, a three-time escapee from Hitler's concentration camps, "No one is so blind as he who refuses to see." What makes people refuse to see in this particular, about this particular issue?
So I think the problem, if I had to sort of be blunt about it, something I have to teach in my classes a lot. I think it's like the sin of Cain and Abel, actually. I think it goes all the way back to the beginning. It's very close.
Yeah.
This admonishment not to envy things is very close to the beginning. And so here's an interesting fact. You can't envy something or take something from someone else if you have the same things, right? So
right.
If you and I have exactly the same things, we have the same gifts, we have the same talents, we're loved by our parents the same way, we don't have anything to envy. So Cain and Abel, what was to envy was that there was something different about them. So I think the reason this refuses to die is because our human nature grates against, our disordered human nature grates against the idea that a good God would give some of us more than others. And
right.
that our relationship to nature is such that this plays itself out over and over, that God's blessings, not only in the spiritual life, some of us have great visions and missions in life, and others of us have a more ordinary path, but our nature grates against that inequality. Because we do sort of deep down, we realize we are all equal in dignity, right? And we are equal in God's eye.
Yeah.
And yet God does not give us all the same gifts. And that's about, you know, the capitalism's greatest sin is the first sin that was recorded in the Bible, right? It's that capitalism cannot ensure for us equal outcomes. It can't do
right.
it, and it will never
right.
do it. And
no.
actually, we don't need to get to formal capitalism. Trading in the marketplace cannot get us equal outcomes. And
right.
no form of human industry or organization, even the family, will not be equal. And so we are offended by that on some level. We are allowed, in fact, we're allowed to be scandalized by that a little bit. I still think the root of this kind of scandal is the same one that's at the root of people who either leave Christianity or want to warp Christianity, because they cannot accept that some people may have eternal punishment. Because at the end of the day, that just doesn't feel right, right? There must be another chance. So I think that's, it's a kind of like, that's the revolt of Satan. It's, this is not a life I'm wanting to accept, right? I won't serve this kind of order.
Yes.
So I think it's very deep. I think this is very deep, and this is why it will keep coming back. This will not be the last time we have to talk about this subject.
Listen here. I want you to come back and back and back, okay? You are an absolute knockout, and I love talking with you, and there's so much more in the book that, you know, we could kibitz about it too.
Yes.
So it would be wonderful. And I just want to tell you that, you know, I just thank you 1,000 times for taking your precious time to jump into the Good Fight ring today, because, you know, I know you're a very busy woman, and I know that it's, you know, it's not easy for you to do these kinds of things. I mean, it's easy verbally, but I mean, not to get the schedule all affixed.
It's such a pleasure. It's true. I mean, things are busy, but
yes.
It's a pleasure. This is, I mean, I will say, definitely on this point, I'll speak for Trent and I'll speak for my, we're both teachers at heart. We really love church so much and the teachings of the church. We do think that it's worth pausing and trying to get these things right, because I really do think it's in the interest of people's, not just their human good, but their spiritual good.
Absolutely. Amen. Well, I want you to know that we will keep you and all your dear ones in mind, heart, and prayer. And may God keep you safe in these challenging days. Keep all of us safe in these challenging days. And we pray for all those who have succumbed to this awful virus. When you look and see what's going on in Italy, and oh my goodness. It's very, very challenging, but the Lord is in control. God is in control. You're listening to The Good Fight, my brothers and sisters, on EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Next up will be Trent Horn, and we will continue our discussion of, can a Catholic be a socialist? We'll be right back.
This is The Good Fight with Barbara McGuigan on EWTN Radio. It's all about saints, past, present, and future. You can be a saint too. Listen and learn. Now, here's your host, Barbara McGuigan.
Welcome back to round two of The Good Fight. The fight is on, and we'll continue to discuss what Pope Leo XIII referred to as the ruin of all institutions. Socialism. And now it's a blessing to welcome back to The Good Fight the co-author of Can a Catholic Be a Socialist, Trent Horn. After his conversion to the Catholic faith, Trent earned master's degrees in the fields of theology, philosophy, and bioethics. He serves as a staff apologist for Catholic Answers, where he specializes in teaching Catholics to graciously and persuasively engage those who disagree with them. Trent models that approach each week on the radio program Catholic Answers Live and on his own podcast, which I just learned about, called The Council of Trent, which is I love it. He has also been invited to debate at UC Berkeley, UC Santa Barbara, and Stanford. Trent is an adjunct professor of apologetics at Holy Apostles College, has written for the National Catholic Bioethics Quarterly, and is the author of 9 books, including Answering Atheism, The Case for Catholicism, and Why We're Catholic, Our Reasons for Faith, Hope, and Love. And today, we'll continue to talk about his most recent book, I believe, which is Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? Trent, welcome back to The Good Fight. It's a blessing to have you, and a great gift that you and Catherine decided to write such a tremendous book. Honestly, can you tell us where we can get this book, Trent?
Certainly. You can get a copy of the book at shop.catholic.com. So you can get it at Catholic Answers online shop website, shop.catholic.com. Also at online book retailers and at a local Catholic bookstore near you if it happens to be open. If you can't get to a bookstore, you can always get it online at shop.catholic.com.
shop.catholic.com. Okay, I just forgot to say that as many times as I normally do in the first hour. So I just wanted to ask you that right off the top. You know, Trent, Pope Leo XIII surely was inspired, it seems to me, to have such a strong grasp on the right to acquire property and wealth. I mean, sometimes I would think people would say, oh, no Pope would think that. But that's not true. And Mother Church and her magisterium cannot go wrong because they're inspired by the Holy Spirit. So in Rerum Novarum, he began his critique of socialism by saying, and this is his quote, "It is surely undeniable that when a man engages in remunerative labor, the impelling reason and motive of his work is to obtain property, and thereafter to hold it as his very own," end quote. So, Trent, please address our natural right to acquire property and wealth, and why do socialists find it wrong for man to own parts of the world and to use it for good purposes?
Right. So what Pope Leo is talking about here, when you look at classical socialism, which is the idea, what Marx is saying and others, that there ought to be no classes, no, there wouldn't be any rich or poor, that all people would have equal amounts of income, equal amounts of property, that everyone would just produce things communally, and then property would be distributed communally based on people's needs. But that doesn't accord with our human nature or how God made us, that God made us that we have duties to provide for ourselves and duties to provide for our families. And so if you have a duty, then you have corresponding rights to be able to carry out that duty. So, for example, if you have the duty to fill up my car with gasoline, then it follows you have a right to drive my car, because you wouldn't be able to fill it up with gas unless you were able to drive it to the gas station. Much the same way, if we have duties to provide for ourselves, to provide for our families through labor, then we have a right to retain the fruit of that labor to be able to support ourselves, and not just at bare subsistence, but be able to save, invest, and be able to use to build up our wealth and then use to be able to bless others.
See, that makes all the sense in the world. I'm always just baffled that everyone doesn't see this, or even just the socialists don't see it. But I think possibly, do you think possibly they just haven't been formed in this sort of thing? They're not educated on it.
Yeah, what's hard is that sometimes, though, people will not understand that the right to private property is not absolute. So while we have a right to acquire private property, that right in and of itself is not absolute. No one has the right to acquire all of the goods of the earth and hoard them for himself. So some people will look at Catholic teaching on what is called the universal destination of goods and say, oh, well, that means that everything belongs to everyone and nobody can own private property. That's not what it means. What it means is that God created the earth for all human beings, but that doesn't mean that human beings aren't able to own some of it for their own ends. The Roman philosopher Cicero actually gave a good analogy for this before the time of Christ even. He said that the right to private property is sort of like owning the seats in a theater. So while the community owns the theater as a whole, no individual owns the whole theater. You can own a particular seat or seats within the theater that are yours to be able to do with as you please. So that's why it's important to remember that when it comes to the right to private property. It's not absolute. I mean, someone has, in the middle of a hurricane, if someone has to break into a store to get medicine for someone who's dying, they have the right to do that in the case of urgency.
Yes.
But these rare instances don't detract from our normal rights to be able to work. And then the reason we work is not to produce goods for a community as a whole to be distributed. It is to receive compensation for the labor that we take part in. And so laborers have a right to that compensation, which goes all the way back to what Jesus said in the Gospel of Luke, that the laborer has a right to his wages.
And yes, and it's the way you put it, it's so beautiful. Also the right to carry out their moral duties to one another. I mean, I didn't mention this in the first hour, Trent, but at the end of each one of their chapters, they have, it's important to remember. And they'll give you just three bullet points of what you need to remember. And that was just a brilliant idea. It breaks it down. This is so good and easy to understand. So I loved how you put that and how socialism, this is the last bullet on this chapter, socialism is flawed because it fails to see that private property allows people to carry out their moral duties to one another, such as by providing for one's family or creating goods and services for one's fellow man. I mean, everyone benefits. This just makes so much sense. In chapter 8, you referred to Clarence Darrow. Can you tell the story of, because this just really, it's kind of stunning when you first read it, how he applied this whole thing. Can you tell the story of Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb in chapter 8, page 69?
Right. This is a rather grim story that we begin to start with. But the point is, when you talk about socialism, and one of the main reasons socialism does not work is because it doesn't correspond to our human nature, that this isn't just a question of economics, it's a question of anthropology. What are human beings and how do we tend to behave? Socialism doesn't work because we naturally act out of our self-interest before we act for the interests of other people. And socialism is predicated on the view that, oh, everyone will always act for everybody else's interests, not for their own. But that's not the case. The human nature is flawed in that respect. And so this is what happened, essentially. So in 1924, Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb, they were teenagers. They're 19 and 18. They lured a 14-year-old boy named Bobby Franks into their car. They stabbed him in the head and dumped his body near some railroad tracks, and then they tried to arrange a fake kidnapping note for ransom, but that fell through and they were arrested. And people were shocked at the time because Leopold and Loeb were young, attractive, highly intelligent young men. There seemed to be no reason for the killing whatsoever. They just seemed evil, and that baffled people's minds. There's no motive for them. They just wanted to kill because they could. So Clarence Darrow, a very famous attorney from the Scopes Monkey trial on evolution in Tennessee, Darrow was their attorney, and he told the judge, you should spare these boys the death penalty. And he said, because it's not really their fault. He said that somewhere in the infinite processes that go to the making up of the boy or the man, something slipped in these young men. So this alternative view of human nature says that human beings start out good and society deforms them. And so if we just got rid of society, or at least the bad things in society like capitalism, which is what socialists would say, then we would have a functioning society. But that's not what Christians believe. Christians believe we are not born good. We are born in a state of original sin. We are born lacking in grace. And that is why we do bad things. So many modern philosophers out of the Enlightenment period wanted to say, like Rousseau and others, that no, human beings are born good. It's society that makes them bad. So we have to change society, and that will make human beings good. And so that's where socialists come in. Socialists think that if you could just make society different, there would not be poverty, there would not be evil, people would live in peace and retain and restore that original goodness, so to speak. But Christians have always held, no, that's not the case. And that is where Pope Leo continues in his discussion of human nature, and to say, no, human beings are not all equal in goodness or even equal in talents. We're very unequal, and society bears that out, and that's why socialism just doesn't work.
Exactly. And that's what you explained so beautifully, because in your discussion on Leo XIII and human nature, the socialist doctrine that society's ills stem from an unequal distribution of human talents and fortunes, and that the solution to this problem is mandated equality. I mean, how would they even devise that mandated equality? And you explain Pope Leo's thought regarding how we need one another. This was just a beautiful thing. I had never read this before.
Right, yes. He says that such inequality that there are, well, first he says there naturally exists among mankind differences that are important, differences in capacity, skill, health, strength, and unequal fortune and unequal conditions. And because of this inequality, he says such inequality is far from being disadvantageous either to individuals or to the community. Social and public life can only be maintained by means of various kinds of capacity for business and the playing of many parts, and each man, as a rule, chooses the part which suits his own peculiar domestic condition. And so basically, socialism strives for a kind of false egalitarianism. So we all should be equal in the sense of having equal rights under the law. We have equal dignity as human beings.
Of course.
But we are not equal after that point. I should not be paid the same that LeBron James gets paid for playing basketball. That would be a crime to pay me what he gets paid for paying it, because he's way better than I am. We're all, because we are unequal in these respects about talent, skills, abilities, conditions, and fortunes, we need one another. We're not independent, you know? So if I want to watch a good basketball game, I need to watch him. But in order to play basketball, he needs somebody else. I doubt LeBron James knows how to make a basketball. You know, people just give
right,
him a basketball.
There you
he
go.
Needs somebody else who knows how to, he doesn't know how to make the basketball or to build a court or to make basketball shoes. He needs those people, and they need him to go off in his shoes, and people like that, and they buy the shoes. And so that's how it works to understand this natural obligations we have towards one another in virtue of these inequalities that socialists try to bring down to, as Pope Leo XIII said, to a kind of dead level, to say that, we're all actually equal and should be treated equally, but that ignores the very important differences that do exist among us.
And you know what? And that's right. He said, bringing humanity down to one dead level. I mean, look at how unique and distinct and unrepeatable every single human being is. You're listening to The Good Fight, folks, on EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. I'm Barbara McWiggin here with Trent Horn. The book is a barn burner. Everybody needs one. We'll be right back.
This is The Good Fight on EWTN Radio. For more information about The Good Fight, go to EWTN.com and click on Radio. Here again is Barbara McWiggin.
Welcome back to The Good Fight. Before we go back to Trent, I want to talk to you about this very difficult time of the coronavirus pandemic and the unprecedented circumstance of widespread public mass cancellations. The Catholics are turning to live streamed masses more than ever. It's a difficult time, but in this time, we can turn to live streamed masses. So as I hope you know, from its beginning, EWTN has been bringing you the Mass every single day, and it always will. You can listen to the Mass live from Our Lady of the Angels Chapel on EWTN Radio at 8 a.m. Eastern Time. And I want to tell you that it also encores every day at noon Eastern Time on EWTN Radio Classics, which starting on Wednesday temporarily became EWTN Radio Essentials. For more than 27 years, EWTN Radio has been your trusted source for the essentials of the Catholic faith. So in this special time of need, EWTN Radio Essentials will be airing the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, now get this, every 2 hours from 8 a.m. Eastern Time through midnight Eastern Time. And between the Masses, listeners can be encouraged by rosaries, chaplets, stations of the cross, and other devotionals, as well as the wisdom of spiritual icons like Archbishop Fulton Sheen, Father Benedict Groeschel, Father Andrew Apostoli, Father George Rutler, and of course, Mother Angelica. You can hear EWTN Radio Essentials on smart speakers, the EWTN app, and at EWTN.com. Okay, back to Trent. Okay, Trent, my producer came up with a great question that I want to ask you about because it's a very interesting question. He said that, Trent, you're well aware that one of Protestants' common objections to Catholicism is the ministerial priesthood, that certain men are set apart to administer the means to sanctifying grace to the rest of the body of Christ. They sometimes say things like, we don't need a man to get to God. Well, here's the question. Do you think this spirit of egalitarianism that we were just talking about before the break, which Pope Leo said was, in essence, bringing humanity down to one dead level, a spirit that permeates socialism and much of progressivism today, do you think, Trent, this is also the same spirit that motivates Protestantism's rejection of the hierarchical church? Do you think this same Protestant spirit born in the 16th century might have helped give rise to the thinking of men like Karl Marx in the 19th century? That's a doozy.
Yes, and it's always, we have to be careful, of course, drawing connections across historical circumstances of time and place and the centuries. But I do find a common thread here in the rejection of authorities among human beings. So when it comes to Protestants said, you're absolutely right, that they rejected the idea that priests or bishops or the Pope were part of any kind of special God-ordained, divinely ordained hierarchy to mediate God's new covenant, to be the ones who would administer sacraments and be the successors of the apostles and have this kind of this authority here on earth in Christ's place. That was something they rejected. They of course, we believe in the universal priesthood, the priesthood of all believers, that whenever we are baptized into Christ, priest, prophet, and king, so we accept there is a universal priesthood of believers, just like how the book of Exodus said that the Israelites were a kingdom of priests. But the Israelites, of course, were a kingdom of priests. It says that in the book of Exodus. And yet they had a high priest and a ministerial priesthood. We, of course, have a high priest in Christ, but we also have a ministerial priesthood. And yes. I do see similarities here with socialists who have tried to say, just the same as you might see Protestants, and say, we just need God. We don't need anyone in between, priests or anything like that, getting rid of that kind of level of authority. Socialists have said, we don't need employers or capitalists. Everyone should be an employer. There shouldn't be a special class of those who have capital and others work for them. I guess just the same as Protestants have said, there shouldn't be priests. We all are just priests. And of course, that just denies the natural roles that we all have, that these roles, whether you're a priest or an employer, it doesn't set you in tyranny over others. It's part of a kind of rightful order that leads to prospering and flourishment for human beings.
Well, good. That's a good response. And I want to ask you, too, can you speak to the thought of Rousseau's belief about human nature? Because, I mean, he got it all wrong. I just want to know, how does socialism fail to account for the reality of human nature? I didn't realize this. You sum this up beautifully in Making Pigs Fly, that section there.
Yes. Well, what we said there is pigs don't fly by their very nature. If you were to somehow make a pig fly, you would have to do violence to their nature. You'd have to surgically graft on wings or something like that. And it would be quite unnatural to make a pig be able to fly in that regard. It is not part of a pig's nature. In the same way, socialism, as I said earlier, relies on all of us acting. The idea is that, oh, everyone will act in accordance with what is best for the community as a whole, and people will put other people's interests first rather than their own, and then we could all live in peace and prosperity. There won't be poverty or misery as long as you just get rid of this darn old capitalism. And two historical examples, well, one past and one present, disproves that idea. First, as we talk about in the book, when the Pilgrims first formed colonies, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they farmed communally. So you didn't get to keep what you farmed. It was put into a communal plot, and then it would be divvied up to other people. So even if you didn't work at all, you still got rations. Even if you worked harder than everyone else, you got the same as everyone else. So when that happened, people just stopped working as hard because why bother? You don't get any more if you work harder. Yeah. And then, of course, because everyone stopped working as hard, the food production began to fail and they faced famine and other calamities. So the governor of the colony said, never mind, everyone farms their own land, keeps their own plot, and they produce more food in that way. Because when something is yours, you actually do take more care of it. We as human beings, we're just really bad at thinking about other people's interests. We think about our own interests first, and that's not bad, really. God made us that way. Yeah. Because Jesus said, love your neighbor as yourself, which implies you love yourself first, you provide for your needs first, and then you provide for the needs of others. So the current example that makes my point well is the shortage of toilet paper and everything, what we're dealing with right now in the midst of the coronavirus, the shortages. Why is that? Well, people, if everyone just stayed home and purchased normally and didn't purchase large amounts of goods for themselves, there wouldn't be shortages. So if everyone said, okay, I'm not going to go out, I'm going to think of other people, and I am not going to purchase a lot of food, and then there won't be a shortage, then there wouldn't be a shortage. But guess what? Lots and lots of people don't think that way. And so that is why we are seeing these kinds of shortages. And now, of course, some people will say, oh, look, capitalism leads to shortages, too. I say, yeah, in times of crisis or unusual demand, but it has an inner mechanism to fix that. And we're already seeing supplies being restocked in many places. As we detail later in the book, these kinds of shortages are par for the course in socialism. You saw it in the Soviet Union. You see it in Venezuela. And so that's what it's like in socialism all the time. So if you hate going to the store now and you can't find things you want and the shelves are bare, that's what it would be like all the time if we lived under classical socialism.
Yeah.
This would be like all the time.
Every time you look at, other countries and you see like Venezuela and they always show the empty and the bread lines, right? And the empty shelves and talking about human nature, I can't understand how Marx came up with the silly notion that in the name of equality, people could share and rotate jobs. You wrote, Trent, whatever conception of genteel living Marx had in mind, most of us don't want our doctor, lawyer, plumber, or electrician to be someone who was a window washer last week or who decided to try this field out as a hobby. I mean, this is hysterically absurd thinking, as much of socialism is. And when we come back from the break, I want you to talk to us about this, how they equalize what is essentially unequal, put it that way. You're listening to The Good Fight on EWTN Radio. I'm Barbara McGuigan here with Trent Horn, talking about, can a Catholic be a socialist? No. We'll be right back.
This is The Good Fight on EWTN Radio. For more information about The Good Fight, go to EWTN.com and click on radio. Here again is Barbara McGuigan.
Welcome back to The Good Fight. And you know, my brothers and sisters, can a Catholic be a socialist? The answer is no. Here's why. By Trent Horn and Catherine Pakalik. I wanted to let you know that it can be purchased at Catholic Answers, shop.catholic.com, or go to any of your Catholic bookstores. I'm sure most of them would be handling this book. It is really an important book, really important, especially for our young people. I would say, Trent, what would you say the age group would be to introduce this? Probably freshmen in high school on up?
Someone in high school on up could read this. As I try to do with all of my books, I try to write them for a wide audience to be able to appreciate them. I personally hate it when authors use prose that is unnecessarily lofty or inaccessible. I write books so they can be read.
Right, you do. And they can be understood. The most profound comments can be completely understood because of the way you write it. Honestly, I was so blessed by this book. It's so comprehensive. You hit on everything. And I think it kind of parents today, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of school you go to, there will eventually be someone who will come up with the fact that socialism is a wonderful thing, especially when we're in this political season that we're in now. So this is the book that gives you the answers that you can really help your kids to be informed, formed and informed, right? And that is so very important. Okay, so now, why did he believe that it's okay to be a plumber or an electrician one day and then to do be a doctor the next day? I mean, that is absurd.
Well, yes, you're correct. It is absurd, and it stems from just basic thinking when it sounds nice at first, like, oh, there won't be any poverty. I mean, we agree there shouldn't be poverty, but for Marx, it wasn't just that. It wasn't just like, oh, I don't want there to be poverty. He didn't want there to be the wealthy either, relative to everyone else. So it's like, okay, so there's no wealth and there's no poverty. That means everybody essentially has the same incomes and we have the same amount of wealth. You start to run into really a lot of problems here. For example, you have an incentive problem. Becoming a brain surgeon is really, really hard, I would imagine. You know, you have to study and study and study for years, and then the work that you do is very difficult, you know, trying to operate on someone's brain. It's very difficult. That's why there's not a lot of brain surgeons. Now, you take many other jobs, like let's say driving Uber or a Lyft or a taxi. That's not easy. It can be, you know, difficult or boring, but you know what? It's easier than being a brain surgeon. It just is, and everyone will admit it. And that is why brain surgeons get paid way more than taxi and Uber drivers, because there's comparatively few brain surgeons in relation to taxi and Uber drivers. But guess what? Because there's so few brain surgeons and we really need them for an important job, they get paid a significant amount of money for what they do. But here's the thing, if a brain surgeon, if you could make the same amount of money, whether you drove an Uber or did or take another kind of job, brain surgery, or how about a very dangerous job, like underwater, the people who use acetylene torches and do underwater construction.
Extremely
dangerous.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. If I can make the same amount of money just driving an Uber, I'm going to pick that. Everyone's going to pick that. So then how are you going to get the brain surgeons and the underwater oil explorers? Well, I don't know. Either government is just going to tell people you have to do this, you're going to force you to do it, or Marx had this idea that, well, we'll all just kind of trade jobs and we'll just switch off from one another. This is a quote of his that I couldn't believe it the first time I read it. He said that once society produces so much goods that there's just a super abundance of goods, people won't have to work hard. He says it'll be possible for me to do one thing today and another tomorrow, to hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, rear cattle in the evening, criticize after dinner, without ever becoming hunter, fisherman, herdsman, or critic. And it's just hopelessly naive when you actually start to read the writings that he puts forward.
Well, naive, but also, what did he have so much against the whole equality thing? I mean, why did that have to become what he has made it to become? It seems like envy. Catherine talked about envy and lack of virtue. Like you are, if someone like we talked about how they're always talking about in this country right now, the 1%, like these are the villains. In life, the producers are villains. And I want to read this to you and to see what you say. This is, I didn't write this, but I think it's very good the way they put it. The folks who are getting the free stuff don't like the folks who are paying for the free stuff, because the folks who are paying for the free stuff can no longer afford to pay for both the free stuff and their own stuff. I know it sounds crazy, but it's to me, it kind of speaks to the whole thing. And the folks who are paying for the free stuff want the free stuff to stop. And the folks who are getting the free stuff want even more free stuff on top of the free stuff they are already getting. So what happens next?
Right.
The people who are forcing the people who pay for the free stuff tell the people who are receiving the free stuff that the people who are paying for the free stuff are being mean, prejudiced, and racist. So the people are being convinced to hate the people who are paying for the free stuff, by the people who are forcing some people to pay for their free stuff, and giving them the free stuff in the first place. How does that sit with you?
Well, I think it is important for us to draw some distinctions. So when government provides entitlement programs, which government can licitly do, things like
yes.
food stamps, public schools, things like that, even
yeah.
things like roads or hospitals, there is nothing free. It has to be paid for somehow. And
yes.
so government pays for that traditionally through tax revenue. Sometimes it can just pay for it through borrowing, but it's supposed to pay that back. It's supposed to, at least. Traditionally through tax revenues, things like that. And so there are going to be people who make a fair amount of income who will pay that income in taxes, and then that will pay for entitlement and benefit programs for others. The problem is when there's an idea that no one should have to work at all and that government
yeah.
should be able to provide entitlements and benefits for anyone who chooses to not work at all. There's a difference between those who are unable to work because of disability
of course.
Or a condition or something like that, and then those who simply believe, Karl Marx's son-in-law, Lafargue, he wrote a very famous booklet called The Right to Be Lazy, saying that we shouldn't
Goodness.
Have to work if we don't want to, and there must be a way to accommodate that. So who wouldn't want a son-in-law whose most famous book is The Right to Be Lazy, you know?
Right.
What a winner.
Right. Yeah, really, what a winner is true. Well, it's just kind of this whole thing. I'm so happy to be learning more about this because I always knew it was wrong, one of those things, but I didn't, you know, and that the way you explain it is just incredible. So socialism, again, gets a state was an interesting chapter. Socialism gets a state. Marx was advocating revolutionary terror. And I want you to talk about where did this revolution come about? Because they thought it would be in England, right? But where did it come about?
They did. Yeah, they thought that Marx and his collaborator Friedrich Engels speculated and predicted, they thought that British workers, the English workers, would rise up. Marx and Engels, their first work was criticizing labor conditions in England at that time. And actually, because of those criticisms, Parliament passed laws to help improve worker conditions. So worker conditions were improved without needing a kind of workers' revolution in that regard. What actually happened, the place where it did happen, was a very unlikely place. It was in Russia shortly after World War One. So Russia at this time was considered an economically backwards kind of country. Only 3% of its population was involved in heavy industry. It was still ruled under the Tsar. It was an economically backwards place. But then the people became discontented after Russia's protracted involvement in World War One. They were dealing with famines and supply shortages, and the young men were being killed in untold numbers as part of a war effort that seemed hopeless. And when all of these elements came together, the Socialist Party in Russia was able to take over, and they were led by Vladimir Lenin. I think his real name is Vladimir Ulyanov, but he wrote works under the pen name Vladimir Lenin to protect his identity. And then from that, the Russian Tsar, his family was murdered. There was the socialist communist takeover of Russia. And then for the next 70 years or so, we had the USSR, the Soviet Union. Soviet is a Russian word that means a workers' council. So
okay.
there were various workers' councils throughout Russia at this time. They were called Soviets. And so the idea was that Russia would become essentially a workers' state or a workers' paradise with a government to help lead it to that end, implementing these kinds of communist principles, such as collective food production, banning the ownership of private property, government commanding the economy and saying how many goods should be produced rather than just having an open market where people can acquire wealth like capitalists did in other countries. But as we detail in the book, that ultimately led to horrible, disastrous consequences over the next 7 decades.
Yes, for sure. For sure. I mean, they surely decimated the Ukraine, too, did they not?
Yes. What happened is the idea with Marx is trying to say, oh, well, you can have a society that just produces so many goods. Your society produces so many goods that you don't have to worry about how many are produced or where they're produced, and there's no poverty. But no real society on earth can be like that. You have to pick and choose what kinds of goods you produce. So the problem is the Soviet Union focused on heavy machinery to industrialize themselves to prevent being taken over by a foreign army or by another rebellion of their own, because they were started with a revolution. Mm-hmm. So that led to things like food shortages. The other thing that happened was, so in order to do this, the Soviet government collected and hoarded food that was produced in Ukraine, and they blamed the original shortages on wealthy Ukrainian farmers. They called them kulaks, which is a Ukrainian word that means tight-fisted. And they blamed the shortages on them when it was the Russian government that was behind this, basically. And so they confiscated the food and livelihood of these farmers. And in 1933, this led to one of the deadliest famines in world history,
yes.
Which is now called the Holodomor. The Holodomor is a Ukrainian word. It means to murder by starvation. So this was a famine that was not like a normal famine, that, you know, just a bad crop yield or something like that. This was 6 million people, and that's a low figure. 6 million people were killed, starved to death intentionally by the Russian government in order to hoard food for the communal efforts and Soviet building projects and things like that. And that's just what happens under socialism, where people are treated as disposable elements to support the state rather than the state serving their interests.
Boy, and this is why then, where you wrote, it's no wonder Pope Pius XI grimly warned 1 year before the Holodomor about socialism sinking into communism and how communism seeks two objectives, unrelenting class warfare and absolute extermination of private ownership. I mean, does that relate to what you're just saying? Yes. I mean, look how violent they became and how they were. I mean,
right.
They knew, was this like a plan in the Ukraine that they could wipe out all these people for a good enough reason?
Well, the idea here is showing people, you know, there's the grim way of looking at it is people just say, well, look, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. You can't make Russia bountiful in its production without doing things that can lead to negative consequences for others, or sending dissenters off to the gulags and forced labor camps of Siberia. It's a disastrous thing that it's not a coincidence that every socialist regime has had a very poor human rights record, because it simply doesn't value the intrinsic dignity of human beings. It's the goal of the state as a whole. That's what matters. So I think that's important to keep in mind, because some people will say, well, you could have socialism without authoritarianism. But authoritarianism always follows socialism, and you need that, because under socialism, for example, the government produces goods and services. You don't have private markets. You can't have one person just making something that's amazing, and then he might become very wealthy because he makes and sells something everybody wants. So you end up having to ban everything becomes a black market, and you need a large security state and police state in order to implement that and make it the case. So you go to Cuba, for example. Cuba is a great example of modern socialism, what it's like to live under that. Most transactions in Cuba are done under the black market. But if you get caught, there are people who have gone to prison for 15 and 20 years for selling eggs and meat on the black market.
Goodness.
Even today, this happened 2 years ago.
I tell you, there are so many different ways I would like to go with this with you, but I don't want to get off topic here. But I want to talk about this. One of the most disturbing principles of socialism to me is their goal to break up the family. And I've done a whole thing on radical feminism and talk that I have. And, you know, the radical feminists bought this hook, line, and sinker and started one of the greatest scourges ever to be seen in America. But feminism found common cause with communist ideology. Breaking up the family was not incidental, but central to that ideology. And, you know, Trent, when I think about this, when you look at those who want to call themselves socialists in this country, they are not opposed in any way, shape, or form to abortion, to assisted suicide. I mean, all the mortal sins, they are not opposed to these things. So basically, they are adopting, I mean, I think Karl Marx wrote in 1884 that human freedom would not be achieved until the traditional Judeo-Christian family was destroyed. And they're singing this same song today. I won't say her name, but one freshman politician was all over the internet, maybe you saw it, lamenting climate change and said something like, I'm not sure anyone should even consider having children. So I want you to explain the socialist viewpoint to stamp out the family and why it's so darn necessary for them to do that.
Right. This goes all the way back to Marx and his criticism of the bourgeoisie, the ruling class, the wealthy, who are locked in a state of perpetual class warfare with the proletariat, the workers, the poor people of society. And so he viewed everything as this kind of class warfare, and he saw everything as contributing either to the exploitation of the proletariat or the workers, or the enrichment of the rich, the bourgeoisie. And one thing he saw as a tool that he felt existed solely to benefit the bourgeoisie is the nuclear family, the family. That's why one of his major tenets, one of the major tenets of socialism is abolishing. You read the Communist Manifesto. One of its main points is abolish the family, one, which he recognized at that time was very controversial to say. But number two was to abolish the law of inheritance. He saw families as primarily being ways of concentrating wealth and then passing it on to children, and that those children had no right to the wealth that they received because they hadn't done anything, any work to receive it, which, of course, goes back to have the right to private property. If I acquire property and wealth, I have the right to dispose of it as I please, including giving it to my children to support them and allow them to pursue their goals in life. And so, which is funny, of course, because socialists rail against inheritance, giving people money they didn't do anything to earn, and yet they want money for not working, just in virtue of being a human being in society. Sorry. They want everybody to get an inheritance from the government, but nobody to work to actually pay for it. So it's a bit of a double standard there when you begin to think about it.
Another absurdity, if you ask me.
That's right. And so that's why it's important to point that out. So Marx, he wanted to break up the family because he saw the family as competing with the state. He wanted us all to be also equally obliged to one another so that when I work, what I create goes to society and my fellow man. Under socialism, classical socialism, our obligations are just to one another as citizens, and no citizen has more of a right to my labor or my interests than anyone else, that we all work, we contribute to the communal plot, and then that's it. And the government distributes that communal plot to everyone based on their need, which goes in the face of human nature, which is no, mothers and fathers work to support their children and then provide for them first. And after doing that, then they are able to turn and provide for others after they have provided for their own families. And that's something that Marx and other socialists just simply could not abide by.
Goodness. And you know what? Another thing you brought up that I was unaware of, I was stunned by the author Sophie Ann Lewis's 2019 book you bring up called Full Surrogacy Now, Feminism Against Family. And I, the first thought of mine was, I wonder what kind of childhood this poor lady endured to write something like this. Explain, we're coming down to the closing mark, but explain what this was all about, how she was promoting surrogacy. What was her idea?
Well, her idea is to look at having children as a kind of work, conceiving, specifically gestating and giving birth to children and raising children as solely in terms of work, and that it's something we should communally take care of rather than putting that burden upon individual families. So she wants to erase the notion, as a modern feminist scholar, erase the notion that mothers and fathers raise children, instead thinking that communities raise children and blurring the line so that there's not individual families, but it's handled communally, that gestating children, raising children is just something that's done more or less as a profession among individuals rather than something that's just unique to family roles.
I mean, to and me.
But it's funny. I think she actually is caring for her elderly mother right now and kind of admits that her own, you know, it's a little bit inconsistent with her own book. And that always ends up happening with these kinds of books.
Right.
These kinds
Thanks
of
be to God's grace.
The Ivory Tower, but not yeah. in real life.
I mean, for her to her goal was to make it normal for us to think about babies as made by many people. That's almost like it takes a village sort of idea, is it not? Kind of?
Right. And we do need each other communally, but not to the exclusion of our natural roles as mothers and fathers.
Parents, yeah. Amen. Goodness. My brothers and sisters, this book is called Can a Catholic Be a Socialist? The answer is no. Here's why. By Trent Horn and Catherine R. Pakalik. It is really good. It will give you so much fodder that you can really discuss this, debate this, because trust me, you will get into some debates about a socialism versus capitalism, and you will have all the answers. It's put out by Catholic Answers Press, shop.catholic.com. And
that's correct, shop.catholic.com.
Yeah, and I bet it's in a whole lot of places because it's really something. And
I will say this.
Yes.
It's available at, normally I don't mention Amazon too often, but you can get it at Amazon. And if you get it there, consider leaving a review because I've had a few socialists who didn't bother to read the book. Leave yeah. some negative reviews. So an honest review would be nice there.
Oh, that would be a great idea. You know, because I neglected to do this, EWTN media missionaries prayerfully take EWTN to parishes and the community through the print and electronic media we provide. So all you have to do is visit EWTNmissionaries.com today, and you can join us in sharing the eternal word with the world. And don't forget, if you do, and I hope you do, purchase this book on Amazon, you will write a good and give Trent and Catherine a very good endorsement, because it really is. I mean, we just touched the tip of the iceberg, Trent. This is why I need you back, like I said to Catherine, because, you know, we didn't talk about the church on capitalism, the church on just wages, capitalism and human labor. I mean, these are all critically important to understand, especially at this time. I mean, I don't know how this election is going to be carried off if we're still going to be in, in our sheltering in place situation, but there's
Hopefully
so
not.
Much more to learn. Right. There's just too much. So much more to learn. So, Trent, thanks a million for jumping into the good fight ring today. God has called you for a mighty purpose. I know you know that. We're so grateful for you and for the mission that He has brought you to, because this is critical for all of us. So may our gracious God give you ever more courage, Trent, and strength, peace, and love to continue to fight the good fight. God keep you safe, good man. And I also want to say a thousand,
much.
Oh, you're so welcome. And a thousand thanks for my producer, Ryan Pennyworth, a million, and to you for listening. Until next week, let us fight the good fight and run the race until we run right into the arms of our loving God. Bye for now.
EWTN is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If your cable or satellite provider doesn't carry EWTN's full programming lineup, give them a call and let them know you would like to receive EWTN 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
For more information, go to EWTN.com and click on television.